still stick to the idea that they are terrorists and that the word terrorism has a certain meaning or legitimacy, without understanding that these terrorists are in fact fabricated by the Bush administration, by its intelligence apparatus, and so on. There's no way forward.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chodosky. Today's show, The War on Terrorism, Part 2. Michelle Chodosky is professor of economics at the University of Ottawa and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. Michelle Chodosky has written a new book, America's War on Terrorism, which is a new and expanded edition of his 2002 international bestseller, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th. This expanded edition, which includes 12 new chapters, focuses on the use of 9/11 as a pretext for the invasion and illegal occupation of Iraq, the militarization of justice and law enforcement, and the repeal of democracy. According to Chodosky, the war on terrorism is a complete fabrication and is a war of conquest. Washington's agenda consists in extending the frontiers of the American empire to facilitate complete U.S. corporate control while installing within America the institutions of the Homeland Security State. Michelle Chodosky, welcome again.
It's great to be on the program.
Are you ready for part two?
I'm ready for part two, yes.
Your new book, America's War on Terrorism, in that book, you say that the legitimacy of the New World Order must be undone. What do you mean by the New World Order?
Well, essentially, I point to the criminalization of the upper echelons of the U.S. administration, where in the name of the war on terrorism, a whole series of criminal acts are being perpetrated, including torture, concentration camps, arbitrary arrests of people of Muslim descent on trumped-up charges, the derogation of fundamental human rights, the suspension of democracy and constitutional government, the militarization of law enforcement and justice, and so on. And this entire construct ultimately depends in a very central way on the legitimacy of waging war on Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda. And if we consult the national security documents, we see the extent to which this central proposition is there. We have to go after Osama, we have to go after Zarqawi, the threat of terrorists to national security, and so on and so forth. So that ultimately there's an ideology, there's a dogma, which is very similar in logic to that of the Spanish Inquisition, which you don't question, and it's that legitimacy which has to be broken. We can't break the legitimacy of this new world order simply through anti-war sentiment, which I think prevails in the anti-war movement. We can't break it by sending petitions to those occupying positions of authority. We have to ultimately unseat the people in positions of authority, and the corporate agenda which lies behind the U.S. administration, if we want to ultimately reverse the tide. I think that is the main focus.
In terms of breaking the legitimacy of the New World Order, you talk in your book, America's War on Terrorism, about the fabricating of dissent, about the formation of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, war protest movements that have been co-opted. Could you talk about the fabricating of dissent?
Well, this is a very complex and sensitive subject, but I believe that controlling the organizations of so-called civil society which are involved either in the anti-war movement or the anti-globalization movement is far more important than actually manufacturing consent. So that essentially what the system is doing is manufacturing dissent and then setting the boundaries of that dissent. And in many instances, we see non-governmental organizations which are funded by the government, by the U.S. government, by the European Union, by the World Bank, involved in a ritual of dissent, when in fact their corporate backers or the people who actually finance them are ultimately in control, directly or indirectly. And we have many instances of this. We notice, for instance, that the United States and Canada are involved in the illegal military occupation of Haiti. And yet, there are a number of Canadian non-governmental organizations which are collaborating directly with the Canadian government. They're funded by the Canadian government, and they are there involved in democracy building and human rights activities in Haiti, which ultimately are accepting, first of all, they're accepting Canadian and U.S. military presence in Haiti. They're working with occupying forces, and they also accept the fact that President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was demoted by a U.S.-led military coup. Okay, so there's no actual dissent which is really directed against the military presence of the U.S. or Canada in Haiti. Okay, so that, again, we have to be very careful. It's not a straightforward relationship because there are lots of very well-intentioned people within these organizations. But I don't think it is possible to fight the New World Order and then say, well, could you give us money to do this? And then put in a request to the Ford Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundation or the MacArthur Foundation or USAID, or the Canadian International Development Agency, and says, please, could you fund us in this particular people's-oriented initiative? And so we are dealing with that process whereby the system actually supports and funds dissent, and by funding dissent, it also sets the boundaries of that dissent. And then what happens is that other forms of dissent, when they emerge, they are subjected to censorship by certain organizations of the alternative media and so on. I think this is absolutely crucial. Who supported the invasion of Afghanistan? Well, in fact, in chorus, all these organizations, the trade unions, the non-governmental organizations, supported the invasion of Afghanistan. And they supported the invasion of Afghanistan on the grounds that this was a just war. And they didn't push their analysis further to focus on the 9/11 events. And the 9/11 events were central in providing the justification for the invasion of Afghanistan. And when the issue was raised by opponents of that invasion, they would immediately, in fact, join the bandwagon of the Bush administration and the international community and essentially foreclose any meaningful debate on the legitimacy of that invasion. And so if we go back in history, let's say to the war in the Balkans, we have the same phenomenon. The so-called progressive organizations, left-wing parties and so on, supporting the NATO bombings. And this is only possible under a scenario where dissent is manufactured. It is not possible when, first of all, when we manage to have an understanding of what's behind these wars in terms of national security doctrine and military agendas. But this is often shoved to the background because many of these non-governmental organizations are very weak on research, and they also, in a sense, are very much influenced by the media disinformation campaign.
Exactly. You talk in your book, America's War on Terrorism, about the government creating its own opposition. And I noticed that after the events of September 11th, 2001, well, before September 11th, 2001, the anti-globalization, the anti-World Trade Organization, the WTO protesters had planned huge demonstrations, I believe, in either Washington, D.C. or New York City or both. And after 9/11, those demonstrations were dropped.
I don't recall the exact circumstances, but what I can say is that the anti-globalization movement did not embody into its discourse an anti-war perspective. This anti-globalization movement is indirectly controlled by the main policy actors. They're often funded by their governments. The parallel summits which take place are often negotiated. It's not to say that there's not meaningful dissent within that, within those organizations. But what I think disturbs me most in the anti-globalization movement, to which I belong and I still belong, is that they fail to integrate an understanding of how war and the free market are, in a sense, concurrent processes. In other words, they do a critique of free market policies, WTO, IMF, World Bank, but they fail to understand how war, in fact, is very much integrated into the free market agenda. And the appointment of Paul Wolfowitz to the helm of the World Bank, I think, epitomizes that process. There's interface between the military agenda and the macroeconomic agenda. And it is only with the war on Iraq that we see some convergence between anti-globalization movements and anti-war movements taking place. But prior to that, there was very little understanding on those questions, and people who were firmly committed in the anti-globalization movement, they actually supported the military interventions, the military intervention in Afghanistan. And there was a deafening silence from all sectors of civil society on that invasion, including the sectors which were vocal in the anti-globalization protest movement.
The same could be said for the so-called humanitarian bombing of Kosovo.
Well, exactly. Kosovo was also another dimension of this, and the anti-globalization movement had very little to say on this, and many so-called progressive organizations did see in Kosovo, they saw the NATO bombings essentially as liberating ethnic Albanians, which constitute a repressed minority. They didn't look into the broader issue of how these bombings ultimately were devastating both Serbian as well as Albanian populations. In fact, the victims of those bombings in Kosovo are primarily the ethnic Albanians. The levels of cancer which resulted from depleted uranium ammunition in Kosovo are devastating, and these are Albanian children which are largely affected as a result of these bombings. And to think that the NATO intervention has some kind of humanitarian mandate is simply to buy the media disinformation which was spread at the time, and which now, you know, in retrospect, people start to say, well, no, the Kosovo Liberation Army was not a liberation army. The Kosovo Liberation Army was linked to organized crime. It was supported by the U.S. administration. It was involved in targeted assassinations of political opponents and so on and so forth. But at the time, a large sector of the so-called left actually supported the Kosovo Liberation Army, tacitly supported the Kosovo Liberation Army. So, yes, this manufacture of dissent is, from my point of view, is one of the main obstacles to disarming the New World Order. Because as long as we have so-called progressive individuals and organizations which support any feature of this military and economic agenda, we are not going to have any meaningful change which is possible. And the other aspect is that many of these NGOs have become lobby groups. They believe that they can implement change by lobbying the Bush administration, by lobbying the WTO, and so on. But they fail to address the broader legitimacy of the New World Order. So in other words, they are lobbying within the confines of the New World Order. They're saying, please, yes, we understand that the World Trade Organization is there, and we understand that there's a military-industrial complex, but could you be a little bit softer on the bombings or a little bit softer on trade reforms? And so that you don't really get that kind of action although it could be, in a certain context, it could be useful, but if it predominates, what it does is essentially upholds the fact that the leaders in high office have a legitimacy, rather than underscoring the fact that these leaders in high office are criminals. They are in blatant violation of international law. They are contributing to the impoverishment of millions of people worldwide, and so on and so forth. So the question of legitimacy is absolutely crucial. You don't break the Spanish Inquisition by saying, could you please not burn as many people? You break the legitimacy of the Spanish Inquisition by disarming the inquisitors. And I think that's really ultimately what we have to do.
Exactly. The dissent doesn't deconstruct or expose the big lie of state-sponsored terrorism and the war on terror.
Absolutely. And that, I think, is, again, it is the stumbling block of any kind of meaningful anti-war movement. As long as people still stick to the idea that there are terrorists and that the war on terrorism has a certain meaning or legitimacy, without understanding that these terrorists are in fact fabricated by the Bush administration, by its intelligence apparatus, and so on, there's no way forward, okay? Because people in the anti-war movement, and I think this epitomizes, in fact, the way the anti-war movement functions. It says, well, we are against the war, but we are against these guys in Iraq who are committing terrorist acts, okay? And we're against the war, but we have to wage an effective battle against Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, and so on and so forth. Well, that is, first of all, it's a very naive statement because it doesn't address the historical origins of Al-Qaeda, the fact that this is a fabricated movement, that it's supported by U.S. intelligence, and so on. But they don't want to go that. They don't want to cross that threshold into raising these very controversial issues. But as long as they make that statement, and as long as the leaders in high office have that legitimacy of going after terrorists, I think we will not be able to achieve a meaningful reversal in, let's say, in the U.S. military agenda.
I'm speaking with author and professor of economics, Michel Chosudovsky. Today's show, The War on Terrorism, Part 2. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Michel, in your new book, you say that the American empire and the war on terrorism, that the objective is to recolonize China, the former Soviet bloc, Iran, Iraq, and the Indian Peninsula. And you go on to say that war and globalization go hand in hand, that Wall Street, the oil giants, and the United States, United Kingdom defense contractors are extending the frontiers of the global market system, that essentially war and globalization are the same thing.
Well, first of all, when I say that the United States is targeting the former Soviet Union and China, I think we have to actually look at the statements which are made in this regard. It's not a rhetorical statement to say that they're going after China and Russia, because they actually, in the Nuclear Posture Review, which was published in early 2002, actually went to the Senate. The Nuclear Posture Review identifies a number of countries which would be the object for preemptive first-strike nuclear attacks. And those include China and Russia, as well as the official rogue states. But China and Russia are members of the international community. They're not necessarily close allies of America. But to make that statement explicit in an official document ultimately does reveal the military agenda of the United States, which is to eventually go after China and Russia. And if you look at recent Pentagon policies, you'll realize, first of all, that the United States is setting up a whole series of new military bases which virtually surround China and the former Soviet Union. It has militarized a number of the former Soviet republics. It has defense agreements with a number of former republics, including Azerbaijan, also the Ukraine, Moldova, and so on, so that in effect their military agreements with these former Soviet republics. And then if you look at the map of that region, you'll realize that the United States now has military bases right on the western frontier of China, because it has military bases both in Pakistan, as well as in Afghanistan, as well as in several former Soviet republics. And then it also has military bases on the west coast of Korea. It has militarized the Taiwan Straits. And so that the whole region, extending from the Sea of Japan right down to the South China Sea, is militarized. And then you look at statements contained in the Project for the New American Century, which was published in the year 2000, which is a military blueprint, which ultimately reflects pretty much the perspective of the Bush administration. It was co-authored by several of the neoconservatives. This PNAC document stipulates very explicitly that the objective of the U.S. administration is to wage multiple and simultaneous large theater wars in different parts of the world. Now, is that not an explicit statement of a global military agenda? I think it is. And if we look at the way in which defense expenditures made, the weapon systems which are being produced by the U.S. military-industrial complex, the deployment of troops and military bases around the world, ultimately, yes, it is a war of global conquest. In the more immediate future, it is targeting the oil reserves of the Middle East and Central Asia. But in the longer term, it is also targeting Russia and China, which in the eyes of U.S. policymakers constitute a threat to America's global supremacy in the world. And then you look at other regions of the world where you have civil wars, such as the civil wars in Central Africa, and then you realize that many of these civil wars, including those in Rwanda, the Congo, Sudan, not to mention Liberia, Sierra Leone, are very much the result of U.S. covert operations in support of paramilitary groups and so on and so forth. So that those civil wars, which are presented to public opinion as being the result of internal factors, if you start to dig a little bit more, you realize that the United States military and U.S. military aid is supporting the factions, the various factions involved in these conflicts.
And what is driving, in your opinion, this global militarization? Is it then the extending the frontiers of the global market system? Are the economics driving this drive toward war, toward global war?
Well, I think definitely war is based on global corporate expansion. War is a profit-making undertaking in many regards. If we look at it more concretely in relation to Iraq, we see that the war agenda supports the interests of the Anglo-American oil conglomerates in the Middle East. It means multi-billion dollar profits for those companies, which are now in a position to confiscate the assets of the Iraqi oil economy, Iraq has five times more oil and gas reserves than the United States of America, so we're not talking about a trivial amount. It's 11% of global oil and gas reserves. In other words, the war ensures an appropriation of the country's wealth, an appropriation of oil resources, which are handed on a silver platter to these multi-billion dollar oil conglomerates. So that, I think, is the first objective underlying the military campaign in Iraq. I would say that the second objective is the boost to the military-industrial complex, is that war is good for business because it brings in multi-billion dollar contracts to the big five weapons producers, of which the largest is, of course, Lockheed Martin. And then their British affiliate or their British partner is British British Aerospace Systems Corporation, so that these companies and other related companies, not to mention the security firms, the mercenary companies, and so on, they get billions of dollars of Department of Defense contracts, and we're talking about a $450 billion defense budget, which incidentally doesn't include the allocations directly related to the war theater in Iraq. So, again, we have the oil companies, then we have the military-industrial complex. I think those are the main beneficiaries of this war agenda. But then we also have companies like Bechtel, Halliburton, and so on, which are involved in the reconstruction of countries affected by war. In other words, the war-torn countries then are handed over to the to these contractors, to these large public utility and construction firms, which then go in with multi-billion dollar contracts. And so the whole war agenda ultimately generates a whole series of profits for different sectors of the corporate, the business community, so to speak, starting with the oil companies, the defense contractors, the big construction companies, and, of course, the financial institutions, which then are on the receiving end because they lend money for this reconstruction and so on and so forth. Ultimately, all of this drives up the public debt, and it also has a devastating impact on social programs. Concurrently with this war agenda, you then see the privatization of social services and so on and so forth. Another dimension of that is the fact that in recent years, we are increasingly going towards what we might describe as the privatization of war itself. And the fact that the companies which produce the weapons are not only involved in production, but they are also consulted on the decision-making process of how these weapons will be consumed, how they will be used. So they are participating in the military agenda directly. Lockheed Martin has a central role in the formulation of U.S. foreign policy. That consultative process between the Department of Defense on the one hand and the military contractors on the other, I think, is a central feature. The military contractors are consulted on how the military agenda is to be carried out. They have secret meetings where they discuss not only the production of nuclear weapons, but also the use of nuclear weapons. And so that these contractors ultimately are narrowly concerned in making money, they have little concern on the impact that these weapons will have on civilians in the war theater and beyond.
You even have a small section in your book on the privatization of nuclear war, and that sounds like what you've just described. Beyond the specific wars that are being conducted now, what about financial warfare, which impoverishes whole societies?
Well, I believe that financial warfare and war are interconnected processes. We are living in an era where financial instruments can be used to destabilize entire national economies, as occurred in Southeast Asia in the late 90s. And where countries' economies can be destabilized, their assets can be appropriated. The case of Korea, I think, is very revealing, where following the collapse of the domestic currency, you had a situation where large sectors of the Korean economy were handed over again on a silver platter to Western business interests. The most advanced high-tech industries in Korea were appropriated. Financial institutions were appropriated. So that financial warfare is also an instrument. It operates through financial mechanisms, through the so-called market mechanism. But it's a process of manipulation. And we see how throughout the world, IMF World Bank reforms have impoverished literally millions of people. And that these macroeconomic reforms are, in effect, as deadly as outright conquest or war, because they impoverish people, they kill people. And I believe that an understanding of the New World Order has to be based on the role not only of these organizations, the IMF and World Bank, and of course the Wall Street financial institutions, but how does this economic agenda interface with the military agenda, with the national security agenda? It's very revealing that in the wake of a war, the World Bank is always there to pick up the pieces. In fact, in relation to the war in Kosovo, 1999, in the wake of the invasion, the World Bank came forth with a reconstruction program which had been written 1 year before the war actually took place. And then we see in Iraq how the large financial institutions, the World Bank, have positioned themselves in the so-called reconstruction process, coming in, imposing policy reforms, establishing the privatization of state assets, and so on, so that this process of privatization and policy interference is consistent with the main military agenda, and vice versa. And that's the kind of understanding we have to reach.
I'm speaking with author and professor of economics, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The War on Terrorism, Part 2. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You've also pointed out in your book that the support of Islamic insurgencies in the former Soviet Union, the Middle East, China, and India are destabilizing whole national societies, and that these Islamic insurgencies, of course, have been supported by the United States.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the United States is, in fact, the architect of these Islamic networks, going back to the Soviet-Afghan War. There's a lot of information on that. Now, it's important for the record to point to the fact that Afghanistan in the 1970s was a secular Muslim society with a high percentage of women in the workforce, in the public sector, and so on and so forth, with a thrust in the area of health and education and so on. But, of course, it was also supported by the Soviet Union, and that was essentially the main objective of the Soviet-Afghan War by the United States, was essentially to destabilize Afghanistan. And what they did was precisely to develop these Islamic brigades as a mechanism to defeat the Soviet Union and to... in fact, the Soviet armies, now we know, came in response to a request by the Afghan government. Once these Islamic brigades had started attacking their security forces and were involved in terrorist acts inside Afghanistan, so that terrorism was the starting point, and it was supported at the time by the Carter administration. And national security advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski confirmed, actually, in an interview, that this was a design of the U.S. administration and the CIA to create these Islamic brigades with a view to destabilizing Afghanistan, which at the time was much more in the orbit of the Soviet Union. And so what happened in Afghanistan was the transition from a secular Muslim society to the Taliban, and the Taliban were also supported by the United States. I think we have to establish the historical record. Now, if we look at what's happening in the former Soviet republics, we see the emergence of Islamic organizations, and these Islamic organizations are coming in with resources. They also have, of course, they have their armed paramilitary groups. If we take the case of Chechnya and we look at the Chechnya's, we look at the role of Chechnya in the geopolitical context, we see that Chechnya is at the crossroads of major oil reserves. The major pipelines going back to the Soviet era go through Chechnya and Dagestan, and so that Chechnya is on the corridor of the oil pipelines. And essentially what happened in Chechnya is the destabilization of Chechnya through these Islamic movements. And then you realize that the main leaders of these Islamic movements in Chechnya, they were trained in CIA-sponsored camps in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And it's fairly well documented. I'm talking about Shamil Bazayev and Khattab, who were the main rebel leaders. So there's evidence, there's certainly evidence to the fact that these Islamic paramilitary organizations were created as a result of a CIA project. Nobody will actually deny that. Whether they subsequently gained some degree of autonomy, I don't think is the issue, but they are still directly or indirectly controlled by the U.S. intelligence apparatus. So that in all these countries, Islamic terrorism has been used to destabilize civilian secular governments. It's certainly true in the former Soviet republics. It was also true in Afghanistan.
With regard to Afghanistan and the global military agenda, you have a chapter called The Spoils of War, Afghanistan's Multi-Billion Dollar Heroin Trade. And we've been talking about war and globalization. How does the cultivation of heroin in Afghanistan, how did that change under the Taliban and then with the American invasion?
Well, ironically, the Taliban, who have been accused by the Bush administration as being behind the drug trade, what they did back in the year 2000 was to implement a very effective drug eradication program to such an extent that by 2001, opium cultivation had fallen by more than 90%. And it was an absolutely impressive change in the opium market, because Afghanistan supplies approximately 85% of the global market. So there you have a government with the support of the United Nations, which implements this massive program, with the production of opium collapsing from 3,300 tons in the year 2000 to 185 tons in the year 2001, prior to the U.S. military-led invasion. Now, what happened was that immediately after the U.S. invasion, which incidentally was also justified with a view to curbing the drug trade, immediately after that invasion, opium production moves up to its previous levels. The drug trade regains its historical position. And in fact, if you look at what has happened in recent years, opium cultivation now has gone from 185 tons in 2001 to more than 4,000 tons in 2005. And so you have a massive increase in the drug trade. And essentially what has happened is that the U.S.-sponsored government of Hamid Karzai has protected the drug trade de facto. Now, if we start to look at what this drug trade represents in terms of financial flows, again, we're dealing with staggering amounts, most of which, I'm talking about the proceeds, do not accrue to Afghanistan. The United Nations estimates that Afghanistan gets out of the global trade in Afghani heroin, gets something of the order of $2 billion. But this trade is estimated. I'm talking about the actual cash value of this trade, which is 90% of the European heroin market and 85% of the global heroin market. It's estimated at something of the order of $100 billion a year. Okay? Now, that $100 billion a year, just to put it in perspective, it's 25% of the GDP of the Russian Federation. So we're talking about very large amounts of money. Now, where does that money go? It doesn't go into the pockets of the warlords, and that's confirmed by the UN study. It essentially goes into the pockets of drug traders, intermediaries, both primarily in the developed countries, in the European Union, and ultimately the big profits of this trade are reaped by those actors linked to organized crime, linked to business interests at the retail and wholesale levels, and that's where the money is made. And then, of course, a large part of this money is then deposited into the Western banking system, so we have a money laundering process. And what is more, and I think that's important, we have to put it in some historical perspective, the CIA is known historically to have not only originated this trade back in the late 70s, but to have reaped large financial gains from this multi-billion dollar trade. And with the proceeds of the drug trade, what do? They finance insurgencies. That is well documented by the book by Alfred McCoy, who looked at the historical origins of the Afghani drug trade. And essentially, when we look at the logic of this trade, from the Taliban to the post-Taliban era, we have to come to the conclusion that as far as who benefits from this trade and what is the significance of the military intervention essentially restores the drug trade. And we're dealing with a trade which, according to United Nations figures, is classified as number three in terms of global volume. The drug trade, in terms of volume and value, is number three after oil and the arms trade. And so it represents a very significant source of accumulation, not in the producing countries, but in the countries where narcotics are marketed, and particularly, of course, in Western Europe and the United States.
So are you saying that the profits from the drug trade are number three? Number one is oil, and number two is the arms trade. Number three, drugs. Are you talking about the percentage of profitability or the volume?
Well, essentially, those figures of the UN are very rough figures. What they measure is really the trade flow. Now, the trade flow is imports and exports of, in the case of oil, it would be crude oil imports and exports. What they do is they estimate the global turnover, so to speak, in trade terms. Now, with regard to drugs, the trade turnover is only a very small fraction of the actual profits which accrue to business syndicates, organized crime, intelligence agencies, not to mention the banking system, which ultimately receives all this money in the form of deposits. But we must understand that the moment the narcotics hits the domestic market, it's imported, let's say, into the United States or into Britain, okay, at a particular price, and that would be the measurement of trade turnover, it then multiplies. In fact, it can multiply by up to 100 times from its import price. And so that, in fact, the total value of this trade at the retail level is much, much larger than the turnover at the level of international trade, because essentially narcotics, of course, is an illicit trade. And because it's illicit, the markups between the import price, the wholesale price, and the retail price are absolutely astronomical. I made some estimates on that and came to the conclusion, of course, that the main beneficiaries of this multi-billion dollar trade are in the developed countries. And that seems to be pretty clear and obvious, because if there was any trickle down of narco dollars into the Afghanistani economy, we would see it. We would see hotels and resorts, and we'd see a little bit of infrastructure. We'd see shopping centers, residential construction, because that is normally the areas where dirty money is recycled. But that process does not take place in Kabul, Afghanistan. It takes place Well, typically it takes place in Florida, okay, where you have a lot of recycling of drug money, and that's fairly well documented, including by official sources, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. So we have to understand that narcotics is big business. We do not have a good understanding of who is behind this trade. In the developed countries, we always talk about the cartels in Mexico and Colombia and the warlords in Afghanistan. But in fact, when you start to calculate the proceeds, you realize that these people are really small players in a multi-billion dollar operation, and that the real sources, the real recipients of this multi-billion dollar trade are, in fact, very wealthy business criminal syndicates in the developed countries. And also, again, I think it has to be mentioned, and also the intelligence agencies, which are known to have supported this trade from its inception in the late 70s.
And, of course, these drug profits are laundered through the global financial system, correct?
Well, exactly. What is very clear is that the financial elites, even though they don't play a direct role in the drug trade, they are, of course, in part the beneficiaries, and they close their eyes to that. And we know that vast amounts of narco dollars are deposited in the banking system.
I'm speaking with author and professor of economics, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The War on Terrorism, Part 2. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, the Taliban had a drug eradication program. Do you think that their drug eradication program worked against their longevity in terms of their being in power?
Well, it does seem that way, doesn't it? Because I'm not suggesting that there's any kind of mechanical relationship, but the moment the Taliban implemented this drug eradication program, they were congratulated by the United Nations. In fact, when you start to go back and look at the timeline, at the very moment the United Nations were congratulating the Taliban for their successful opium ban, it was in October 2001 that the United Nations, through the UNODC, it's the Vienna-based organization, it's the acronym of this UN body, which deals with crime and narcotics. And that report was presented to the United Nations General Assembly in October, at the very moment when U.S. forces were bombing Afghanistan. And so, in effect, it's true that de facto the invasion led to the reinstatement of the drug trade. If that invasion had not taken place, there's a good likelihood that the narcotics trade in Afghanistan would have gone into a depression or a recession. And this would have created shortages in the European narcotics market because Afghanistan was supplying 85% of global supply. So, yes, indeed. I don't think this was the main reason, but it certainly was one of the reasons from a geopolitical, economic, and financial standpoint to invade Afghanistan and restore the drug trade. And we're dealing with very powerful business interests, which certainly have a voice in the corridors of Washington and certainly within the European Union in political circles, and certainly have an indirect influence on the conduct of military operations.
With regard to the global war on terror, is the war on terrorism used to justify the use of nuclear weapons?
Well, that's a very important question. We are currently going through a very serious crisis, with threats being made against Iran in particular. And in fact, the Bush administration has not ruled out reprisals directed against Iran for its alleged nuclear weapons program. But these reprisals, these punitive bombings, would be using thermonuclear weapons, so-called tactical nuclear weapons, or in some cases they're called mini-nukes. But they're not so small, because the type of nuclear bomb which the Bush administration is contemplating using against Iran is two-thirds the size of a Hiroshima bomb in terms of explosive capacity and in terms of yield. And so, yes, indeed, the war on terrorism, of course, is the justification for preemptive military action, which, if you read the statements, both the presidential speeches as well as some of the documents emanating from the Pentagon, the national security statements, you realize that the justification for waging war on a preemptive basis is the existence of Islamic terrorists. And the fact that these Islamic terrorists are a threat to the security of the United States, and that they're being supported by rogue states, rogue enemies, and so on and so forth. So that the whole notion of preemptive military action, which essentially means that you go after the enemy before they attack you, is based on the existence of these Islamic terrorists. And we know from the mountains of research that have been conducted that these Islamic terrorists, as far as the networks are concerned, I'm talking about the Al-Qaeda, are a creation of the U.S. intelligence apparatus. And so what the Bush administration is doing, and the Clinton administration did it previously, is to fabricate an enemy, to portray this enemy, and to feed disinformation into the news chain, and then to formulate its military agenda based essentially on two pillars. If you look at all the statements, the two pillars of the national security doctrine is, one, the fact that rogue states have weapons of mass destruction, and the second pillar is that we must go after Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, which constitutes a threat to the security of the homeland because Al-Qaeda possesses nuclear weapons or plans to acquire nuclear technology to use it against Americans and American cities, etc., in the form of a dirty radioactive bomb or even a small-scale nuclear device. So that what's happened is that by using the war on terrorism, realities have been turned totally upside down. Iran is portrayed as developing nuclear weapons without substantiating evidence. And secondly, Al-Qaeda is portrayed as an upcoming nuclear power with the capacity to develop nuclear weapons and use them against Americans. In contrast, the United States of America does have nuclear weapons, but these so-called tactical nuclear weapons are considered to be, quote, safe for the surrounding civilian population, unquote. That's part of the new Pentagon doctrine. So that what they're saying is the terrorists have weapons they want to use against us, which in fact they don't, okay? They don't. They simply don't. They're not a military power. They're, even if they exist, they don't have the capacity to confront the United States of America with its $450 billion defense budget. But in contrast, the United States says, yes, we've got these nuclear weapons that we're developing, and they've gone to arm's length to say that the B-61 thermonuclear bomb, which is two-thirds of a Hiroshima bomb, which they intend to use in the Middle East war theater, is safe for civilians because the explosion is underground. But if you start to go through the literature, you realize that, first of all, the explosion is not underground. It is 20 feet below ground, which means that, in fact, all the rubble simply explodes up towards the surface, not to mention the radioactive fallout. So it's a nuclear explosion. And they say that in case this type of bomb were to be used, it would result in tens of thousands of casualties, and it would also lead to radioactive fallout throughout the Middle East. So that what we're talking about is a nuclear holocaust. I think we have to be very clear that the use of these nuclear weapons, which are intended to go after Al-Qaeda terrorists or rogue states or dictators in their bunkers, could potentially lead to a nuclear holocaust. So we're in an extremely dangerous situation where the war on terrorism, which is based on a fabricated enemy, is ultimately leading us to the unthinkable, nuclear war, preemptive nuclear war to go after the bad guys. But of course, the ultimate objective is not going after the bad guys, the terrorists, the rogue dictators. The ultimate objective is oil. And it just so happens, and this is something which is fundamental, it just so happens that close to 80% of the world's oil reserves are in countries inhabited by Muslims. And that's not only the Middle East. It's the Middle East, Central Asia, North Africa, West Africa, okay, if we're thinking of Nigeria. It's Indonesia, which is a major producer of oil. It's Malaysia. So that if you start to look at where the oil is, close to 80% of the world's oil supplies are in countries which are inhabited by Muslims. In other words, this demonization of Muslims, the way in which Muslims are presented as terrorists, the clash of civilizations, all this ties into a global military agenda which intends to use nuclear weapons to go after the terrorists, but with the ultimate objective to secure control over oil reserves.
Well, Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being on the program.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with author and professor of economics, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been The War on Terrorism, Part 2. Michel Chosadovsky's new book, America's War on Terrorism, blows away the smokescreen put up by the mainstream media that 9/11 was an attack on America by Islamic terrorists. Chosadovsky reveals the war on terrorism to be a complete fabrication. His website, www.globalresearch.ca, contains articles he has written, as well as articles by researchers from around the world. That's www.globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is edited and produced by Yara Mako and me, Bonnie Faulkner. To leave comments or order copies of the show, call 510-848-6767, extension 628. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.net or visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution?
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Tonight at Humanist Hall in Oakland, Mike Rupert's classic, Truth and Lies of 9/11. Admission is free. Hosted by Gypsy, who will have CDs of Guns and Butter shows at the event, as well she will play her confrontation with 9/11 Commissioner Richard Benvenisti. Humanist Hall is at 390 27th Street in Oakland. Showtime at 7 p.m. tonight. That's a free event. Mike Rupert's classic, Truth and Lies of 9/11. Tomorrow night, Thursday night, February 23rd, at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, the world premiere of a film featuring Dr. David Ray Griffin's October 2005 lecture, Flights 11, 175, 77, and 93, the 9/11 Commission's Incredible Tales, as well as the Dutch television documentary 9/11, Attack or Godsend. Two prominent European politicians, Michael Meacher and Andreas von Bülow, express their doubts about the official explanation. Featured activists will speak, including Jeanette McKinley, who was at Ground Zero on 9/11. I will be there tabling. That's tomorrow night, Grand Lake Theater in Oakland at 7 p.m. I hope to see you there.
You are tuned to your listeners.